We're at Algoma, Wisconsin, and we're talking to Mr. Herlash, and he's going to talk about fishing.
How did you learn to fish, Mr. Herlash?
Well, I've learned the biggest part of it when I was a kid, I suppose. Say, when I went to school at Newmore, where my granddad was living. See, he lived right in near Newmore, within a half a mile from where the Newmore Church is today. And he'd show me all what he'd do, what they fished, and explain it to me. And, well, I knew he had an idea what it was all about. So then, after that, he told me where they were fishing, and he says, your mother, he says, she spent a lot of time with us. He says, just coming up and staying up there at Riley's Point, just for cooking and drying them slats. Them floats.
The wooden ones.
The wooden ones. Mm-hmm. They dry them in the oven every day. As long as they could, in order to have them dry. Because they had no way of treating them. They didn't have no linseed oil, you know, that they could soak them in at that time. They just used plain lumber. And a lot of it was split and hewed with an axe and trimmed off and cut a hole in the slot. They weren't sawed like sawed lumber is today. That was their first start. And the sinkers, then they used the stones.
What kind of wood did they use?
They mostly used cedar, because cedar splits straight. Or white pine, if they could get a good straight white pine. See, it'll generally split straight, and then they could hew it, and then they could cut it out, you know, and trim it up much faster and easier.
Was that cedar from the area?
Hmm?
Was that cedar from the area that they lived
in? Oh, yeah,
in?
That was all, most of it was red cedar, right here in Wisconsin. That's what it was.
Right.
They used to make shingles. They used to split them for shingles for shakes years ago. So this, they do it the same way. See, they split this and use it for their slats.
And the stones here, how did they carve them out?
Well, the stones, they carved them out mostly with a hammer or with a chisel or anything sharp that they could get in there and hollow out a spot where they twine with and slide off. To tie it on so the stone would stay there. And at length of time, they always had to have some extra ones, because whenever you're pulling that net to lift every time, you're dragging that on the bottom, and if you're on a stone reef, you're wearing the twine off of these stones. So then you would have some to replace. So they've always had to carry some for replacement, too.
What kind of nets were you using when you used the stone sinkers?
Gill nets. They were all gill nets. Either a small mesh, like for perch and herring at that time, or that was about a 2 3/8 and up to 2 3/4 in size. That's stretch measure in twine size.
You're talking about the opening of the net.
The mesh. It's the square mesh, but when they measured it, it stretched from one end to the other, tight, and that's what they call 2 3/4 or whatever it was. That it had to come to that measurement. And their whitefish net, their big mesh, which they caught whitefish, they caught trout, they caught sturgeon, caught suckers, they caught everything. They were 4.5-inch mesh. But they started about 20 mesh deep, where today we've got them 100 mesh deep.
What does 20 mesh deep mean?
That means every square mesh whatever one that makes a 4.5 inch is a mesh. Mm-hmm. See? And that's the way they're figured. They're figured to 4.5 inches, see? And you can figure the depth. So now there's a lot of these nets are more than 100 feet deep that they're fishing today.
You said that, too, that there was a difference in the running boards that they used at that time?
In the running poles?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sure. Years ago, they had to make them all by hand. They went out and cut cedar trees down, and then they peeled them, you know. Cut the knots off, made them as smooth as they could. And then they had to shave them, either shave them or saw them off and split them in half and put them together and nail them. The best they could. But they were hard to handle because they always rolled. You know, they never, and the current would take them if they were fishing underneath the ice. Where 1 inch, you figure the difference between a 1 inch board or a 3 inch piece. It takes that much more current if there was heavy current. So sometimes they had to make 3 or 4 holes in between to set one net, where afterwards when we started, we'd only make one hole in between.
When they made the holes, what did they use to make the hole?
They used a chisel and axe. That's about what they first started with, and then which they're a big mesh, they chisel sometimes one side, just a slot, 6 inches or so wide, and then it saw the rest out.
How deep was the ice usually?
Well, it all depends. Some winters it was probably 1 foot or 2, and sometimes it went as high as 3 or 4 feet. It depends on the kind of winter they got. And sometimes they run in rough ice, and then they had troubles.
Where did your grandfather learn how to fish?
Hmm?
Where?
That, I don't know if he fished before he ever came to this country or not. And I never asked Mother about it either, but I don't think he did.
Mm-hmm. Did your mother tell you any stories about things that happened out on the ice? You know, problems, or were there any stories about the fishing and tragedies or super catches or anything like that?
Well, the only biggest of their troubles that they've had, they've always had to carry a bridge, what they call kind of a board or something to, if the ice broke open or there was, where it was cracked and broke up, they couldn't get across, they had to put that on to get the horses across at that time. See? Their sleigh, they could always pull it across. You know? Because sometimes the ice would shove up and sometimes she'd open up and it would be broke, floating, see? But you had to have something like a flat surface to be able to walk the horse. Then if it opened too wide, they'd cut a cake of ice big enough to float the horse and float the horse across on the other side. That's been done good many times.
Well, that'd be a pretty big cake of ice then, would it?
Oh, yes. It all depends on the depth of your ice. See, mm-hmm. If you had heavy ice, it don't take as much because it's got more. But if you got thin ice, pretty risky. And sometimes the water, it even become up maybe 1 foot or 10 inches on top of the ice yet, but they pull it across.
What causes the ice to do this?
The current generally does it. See, your current from your Great Lakes brings in your pressure up into Green Bay or up in Lake Michigan the same way. It runs up half a day and half a day back. When the pressure comes just so strong, then it's got to go back. See? So when the water's crowded in here, well, that ice's got to get up, got to float up. So probably it cracks open, see? When it goes down.
So your grandfather knew those kinds of things too when he fished?
Pardon?
Your grandfather had to know about how the current flowed.
Oh, sure. Fish. There was days that whenever you lifted lifted nets from underneath the ice, you'd pull them. Your yank would probably be running east and west, and your nets would be coming from the north or south. It was just that strong, you know, that they'd just float over. And a lot of times they had to tie their running line on something on the end if they were on clear ice, otherwise it would go right in.
How many men did it take to pull up a net?
Well, on your perch net, generally one man used to pull them.
How much did they weigh?
Oh, they don't. The net don't weigh too much. What makes it the hard pulling is the current, see? And the more fish you got in them, the easier they float and the easier they pull. They seem as though they work themselves as you pull. But then on your big mesh, like a 4.5 inch, they're mostly two men. Because they had to pull them out on one side and pile their stones on one side and their slats on the other, you know. Or because when they came to pull that net back in, how would they have got in? Everything would have been one great big mess, all tangled up. So this way, one guy stayed, and the other guy went up and took the running line at the hole, and he started coming back towards the shanty where the fellows had the nets in. And he'd hold them up, and then in the hole they'd go. The twine, it always go. That's the way they put them in. And it's the only way they could do it.
How long were the nets?
Most of them made them 300 feet. Some of them made them shorter, so 250, but there wasn't too many 250s. Mm-hmm. They were mostly 300.
What did you use to mark the locator? What kind of a locator did you have so that after you set the nets and went back out?
Well, most of the time they did, in the winter time, they took an evergreen of some kind, a cedar or something, and they just put it on the end of the, where they started. They mostly started from the shore that they came left to go on the ice, and then they set that up, and you could see that for a long ways. Sometimes they even made their whole road that way, way to shore. Every so often put a cedar bush in case of storm. So they had some to go by.
How did you figure out which places to fish? How did your grandfather teach you that?
Well, he's, like he said, he says, it depends on what time of the year the fish is. They keep moving. And you sometimes got to keep moving with them. And you got to find which way they're moving.
How do you find that?
Well, generally the way you find that is you go down the corner of the average on how many is gilled from one side or the other. See, mm-hmm. If you raise your floats mm-hmm. up and they're all gilled from one side, they're going the opposite direction. Or if it's the other side, they're going the other way. But then sometimes it's hard, you can't tell. It's because they move on reefs a lot of time. Where there's a reef, they'll come up on the reef to feed, then they go back down to shallow water. That's the way they work.
Was there any thievery? Did people steal the fish out of someone else's nets?
Oh, sure. Some would steal the fish out. Some would even steal the twine. They'd steal the nets. But there wasn't really too much of it because most of the time things were marked. Mm. I'd still got some lead here that's marked, initials are on them, see. But I'd put your stones, when they had it years ago, they couldn't hardly mark them. They had no way of marking them. Because if you even cut them strings off and throw them, but in the years going by, when I fished, well, we had all our leads on the meter cord. We'd run so many lead in there before we start stringing. Mm-hmm. to make one net complete, see. But them, they didn't use none. They just strung the whole twine and then they tied these stones on. And they put the float just on the top in line with it. And a lot of time, if they thought that the fish didn't have enough slack twine, they reefed them down. They put a shorter, supposing there was a 12-foot, they probably put a 9-foot piece of seaming twine from the sinker down the bottom to the float. So it would make kind of a bag. See, so the fish would get in there and then it'd get rolled in. But with the boat, we very seldom, we never did with the boat, reefed on the nets. But in the winter time, in the ice, we reefed them just about all the time.
Did your grandfather fish with a boat too?
No. He had his farm and he went back farming him. He had his family and the rest took care of the farm and he was fishing.
But in the wintertime when your grandfather would go to go fishing at Raleigh's Point, then your grandmother went along. Did she ever go out on the ice with them?
No.
She stayed?
No. They always stayed back to make meals and take care to dry out them. And do whatever had to be done. Mend clothes, dry their mitts, because they had mittens there, a sack full of them, see. When one pair got wet or too cold, well, they'd even hang them around the stove in a shanty, and some would dry out, but it took too long, they'd grab a dry pair.
Tell us about the mittens.
Well, the mittens, they made them out of everything. They made them out of woolen underwears, or some of them even had knitted mitts inside. They spin their own wool, and then they knit their mittens, just and their stockings the same way.
Did you use anything else on top of the wool mitten then?
They use either bed ticking or canvas. They used to have a bed ticking like they used to have for old mattresses years ago. Well, they didn't have no mattress. They used just a ticking, a great big sack, myself saying. They put straw or corn husk. Or wool, if they had a lot of wool. That's what made their best and warmest bed. That's the way they done it. They done it out of an old coat or anything that could be used to make a mitt.
So about how many pairs did each of you have?
Oh, well, it took sometimes, it all depends. Some guys took more than others. Because a lot of times, you know, you shake them off and you tie the nets with your hands and then you slip your hands back in. But then if you're working like on something that was wet, like on setting nets, and you use that pusher to push the pole, well, that was wet a lot of times and you'd get your hands pretty wet. And it took sometimes 4 or 5 pairs a day. It all depends on the temperature, the weather.
Was there anything that would keep you from getting your hands really cold? Could you do anything to
yes.
help prevent
it? The thing that we used to do, and it was this old French Canadian, the one that taught us that. He says to use kerosene. He says pour kerosene in your hands and rub them good. Just rub them. He says the first thing in the morning. He says and they'll stay warm all day. And we used to mend pond nets, and our hands would be warm. No matter if your gloves were a little wet or mittens were wet, it didn't make no difference. They stayed warm. Because I think it closes the pores of the skin, see? So the cold air couldn't get in. Yeah, well, it's below zero weather. We'd mend pond nets.
Mm-hmm. Did the French Canadians teach you any other things about fishing that they knew?
No, not too much. They were pretty much the same as the Belgians were. They worked right amongst with us all the time. And when what one had, and he finally get a better idea, well, the other guy would get it from him. And if we had it, well, we could let him have it. And that was the way it went.
How did you talk to each other? Did you speak French?
Well, yes, because I was born French. I could talk French pretty near as good as I could Belgian there for a while. Because I was, because it wasn't really French, it was the Canadian French. That's different than the regular French. And every once in a while I go back there, there's still one guy living. He's a little older than I am. And he'd start talking French-Canadian to me again.
But most of the Belgians could understand the French-Canadian.
Oh, yes. Because my mother always wrote back to Belgium, and all her writing was in French. Mm. Oh, yes. All French. Every bit of it. Who taught her? Well, her mother, and she picked that up, you know, from her mother in the writing. And she'd write back in French. And here she was going to school to learn English, of course.
You told us that your mother helped out with the fishing. Can you tell us more about that now?
Yeah, she must have started, well, I'd say before she was married, because she was married when she was 26. She started about when she was 19. She used to go up and help them.
What would she do?
Well, she'd just go out there and keep fire and keep the make meals. Well, they were gone sometimes for all week or 2 weeks. It all depends how much fish they got.
On the ice, they were gone for that?
No.
Well,
I mean back at Riley's Point where they were fishing from.
Uh-huh. Did they have a kind of camp set up?
No, they had a cabin up there, a great big log cabin. And they had a place to put the horses in. And then they had to haul feed back there to feed the horses.
Was the cabin just your family's, or did other families share?
Just their family.
And did they make that just for fishing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just for fishing, just for winter use. That's what they had it for.
What did you eat?
Hmm?
What did you eat at the cabin and out on the ice?
Well, they packed their lunch. There was a lot of pork. Pork was their biggest food because they could keep it easier, see? They could cook it ahead or salt it. A lot of salted pork at that time. And then they'd soak it in milk when they had milk, to cut the salt out before they fried it. So beef, well, I suppose they used some beef, and then they had fish. It never was without fish or something to eat. And potatoes, I suppose they took their potatoes with them and some vegetables and stuff, most likely. Because they had, it's just like if you went out to a picnic, you're going to take some with you, or if you're going out for a week to stay, you're going to take some groceries. Mm-hmm.
How about bread?
Well, they had to bake. They had to bake their own bread.
Did they have an outdoor oven up there at that cabin?
No, at that time they had a stove already, so they could dry their floats.
Did your mother ever pull the nets on the ice?
No.
Did she set nets?
No, she never set nets. She never went out on the ice. She always just went out there to help them to... So they'd have the dry sticks and the stuff mended. If they needed more rocks, she'd make all that stuff and make the meals.
So she would stay on shore?
Oh, yes.
She never went out?
Yeah, she never went out.
Were there any other women in camp with her, or just your mother?
Well, yeah, she's had some of her other sisters go with her, because there was quite a family. There were 11 girls in the family. So... once in a while, I suppose some of the others would go with them.
What did the other children do when they stayed at home, when your mother was gone?
They do the chores, take care of the cattle, and clean the barns, and whatever had to be done. Haul the water, haul the wood. Because everything had to be carried in them years ago.
Mm-hmm. What did you do for water at the camp?
Just cut a hole out in the ice and take a pail and bail it out.
There wasn't pollution then?
No. Oh, no. We used to make coffee all the time on the ice. Just bail it right out, put it on the stove, put your coffee in and make your coffee pot. Used to drink it.
Mm. When did the pollution come in?
Oh, the pollution started coming in here about, I'd say, in the late 20s, mm-hmm. somewhere Sunday.
How did that change things?
Well, how did it change things? It got sort of intertwined. It was coarse looking, kind of slimy, you know. Coarse, you couldn't keep it clean.
This is one thing you told me about before, speaking of the cleaning. I think you, when I was over here and you were showing me how to use the net and all, you went into quite a bit of detail about cleaning the nets.
Yeah.
And before we go on with pollution, would you tell us a little bit
about
how you clean the nets in the summertime, the wintertime, and you know, how it varied on the ice and all of that.
And when you were fishing them on the ice, when we lifted the nets, they were on a piece of canvas maybe 5 feet square or something, you know, just about 5 feet. They'd lay that right next to the hole. And they'd pull their twine on there. And then they had a pail or a dipper or something. They'd take the hot water. So they had a stove and it'd burn wood all the time to heat that water. And they had homemade soap. They made all their soap years ago, the older people. And they had that in the boiler. And then they'd pour that on their nets over the twine, and then they'd tramp it. Just work it good, you know. Work it
tramping in. Is, how with, would you do that?
With your feet.
With your feet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They all wore rubbers or boots, you know, and they just tramp it on, you know, and that would kind of sponge it out, see? Just like you take a plunger on some and just, like years ago, they had them plungers way back years ago for washing, but they'd have done it with their feet. And then as they set that in, you could see that slime and that stuff just come off, and that twine look clean again, see? Why, if you'd have set it back the way it was, why, you'd have probably wouldn't have had no fish the next time. And the small mesh, we'd pull them mostly, we'd take a gunny sack and we'd rip it open, and we'd pull the twine all into just both meters together in twine and all, and then we'd take them after the fish was picked out, and take the four corners and take it and put it into the boiler. Kind of a boiler they had on the stove, and they'd pull that up and down, work it, you know. Work the dirt out, and they'd put the boiler there, and the next guy'd pull them, and one man would set it in. You'd always let the lead on the left hand hang, and your right hand took care of your twine and your corks, see, or your sticks, the same thing. But I still think when they first started, they had to be at two to set up a small mesh because them sticks were too unhandy. I know Grandpa always said, he says it always took two. But after they got the corks, then that was altogether different. Because they'd roll out more, see.
When, as you were washing the nets and pulling it in, did you watch for tears?
No, we never did any repairing in the winter time. If we had any that was ripped too bad, we just took it out and put another one in.
Well, about how many nets did you have at one time? Did you have a whole supply?
Oh, sometimes we had over 300 foot nets. We had them set in different gangs. I remember the time I fished that they were close enough together that we could just about hook our anchor lines from one to the other.
There were that many people fishing?
Oh, everybody was fishing. Everybody was fishing. Everybody trying to make an extra dollar in the wintertime. That's when times were hard. But I remember times that we could only run 10 nets a day, two men, perch nets. And we'd come back with over 1,000 pounds of fish, 100 pounds in the net. Now you figure them little perch, how long would it take to pick them?
Pick them.
Yeah, well, that's why we got that haul, see?
We'd push. Which one is that?
That's a shuttle. That's what they call the haul.
And what did you use this for?
They use it for if the twine was around them gills. If you ever seen a perch or a pike or anything, they got them rough gills and they're sharp. Mm-hmm. Well, they take this and run it out, pull the twine back far enough. Then they take the fish and squeeze it, poke this through the eye, or get the finger in the gill, pull the fish out. But perch, we always use this. So you always had something to pull your twine, see? Like I'd be pulling this. And then you'd stick it through the eye, and your hand is around it this way. Throw it in a box. But your whitefish, the same thing. If they were too big, they had to be backed out. Otherwise, you bust the mesh. And for the big mesh, then they use a gaff hook to hook them as they came if they were big and fighting so they wouldn't tear too much the twine.
What kind of hook is that?
Like? That's a hook about 2 feet long, with kind of a steel hook on the end, see? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They'd hang at the shanty, or whenever they needed, they grabbed it. It was there, all of us.
Okay.
I think we should turn over the tape now.